Coming up now, the Space Show. Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, we look back 50 years when the final lunar mission had just concluded. So, let's head off then with REM. Yes, and we do believe. Yesterday was the 50th anniversary of the return to Earth of Apollo 17, the sixth human landing mission to the moon. At 6:55 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time, Apollo 17 splashed down in the Pacific Ocean after a space flight of 12 days, 13 hours and 52 minutes. Aboard were Gene Cernan, Harrison Schmitt, and Ronald Evans. 10 years ago, an event was held at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. It was held on 2012, November the 13th. And, well, you're going to hear a narrated feature, and Phil Rogers is the journalist, the moderator, and let's hear how that event began.
To launch the final manned mission to the moon. To commemorate Apollo 17's 40th anniversary, the Adler Planetarium invited the two remaining crew members to relive their experiences with the media and leave impressions of their hands and boots to be put on display. Captain Eugene A. Cernan was the pilot of Gemini 9, lunar module pilot of Apollo 10, and commander of Apollo 17. He is the last man to leave footprints on the lunar surface. The Honorable Harrison H. Schmitt was the lunar module pilot of Apollo 17. As a geologist, he is the only scientist astronaut to ever land on the moon, and later served as New Mexico's senator. For the anniversary event, they were joined by Captain James A. Lovell, who flew multiple Gemini and Apollo missions. A longtime friend of the Adler Planetarium, Captain Lovell has served on the Board of Trustees since 2007. As a part of the opening and dedication of the new Samuel C. Johnson Family Star Theater, these three human space exploration pioneers sat down for a spirited discussion with NBC Channel 5 Chicago's investigative reporter, Phil Rogers.
Thank you. I want you to know something. I was 16 years old when these two gentlemen went to the moon, and I remember that my family had just gotten a color television set in Oklahoma. It was the first time we ever had one. And so we got to watch this in color, and I was just sitting here thinking, they saw this in color. They didn't need to see it, and we're going to hear about some of that tonight. I want to start with Captain Cernan, and I know you feel strongly that the story of Apollo 17 is not just the story of Apollo 17, but it's the story of everything that came before.
You know, a lot of people have wanted to have events from one end of the country to the other to all of a sudden people to recognize that Apollo 17 was the end, was the last flight to the moon. And a lot of people can't realize or accept the fact it was 40 years ago. And a matter of fact, we have a generation and a half of which you are part of, some of who weren't born when Neil Armstrong walked on the surface of the moon, or at best in diapers and knee pants, or maybe teenagers when when Jack and I walked.
And 55 Chevy, or?
I would have wrecked it.
And I like to look at tonight and any other recognition of Apollo 17. It's not about Jack, not about Ron Evans, it's not about me, it's not simply about Apollo 17 or the final footsteps of Apollo. It's about what happened in this country almost a half a century ago that started with Alan Shepard, the first American in space, who made those steps into space. Actually, I look at them as the first steps to the moon before we even knew we were going to the moon. That whole period of time, and it included all of those pathfinders of Germany, the Shiraz, the Glenns, and the Coopers, and the Carpenters, and the rest of them. The Gemini program, the things Jim and those of us who had a chance to fly in Gemini, all the way through Apollo, to the final conclusion of Apollo, which was, I look at it as December 14th. We came home on December 19th, but December 14th, to me, concluded an era in American history that exuded American exceptionalism, and that's what we're really celebrating tonight, as far as I'm concerned. That's what's important. You know, you've heard the phrase, we stood on the shoulders of giants. And we've used that, and we did stand on the shoulders of giants of a nation. But Jack and I stood on the shoulders, in addition of a nation, of our colleagues like Jim Lovell, who preceded us and made what we did on Apollo 17 possible. That's what tonight is all about.
You know, I think there isn't.
Could I just add one thought to that wonderful statement of Gene's? In standing on shoulders, we were standing on the shoulders of people whose average age was in their 20s. The Apollo program was a program that young people did. And everyone needs to realize that when you want to do great things, peacefully or not so peacefully, you depend on young people. It's their courage, their stamina, their motivation that makes it possible to get those things done. For no other reason than they don't know how not to succeed. So just keep that always in mind, that Apollo and other major things this nation has done has been done by young people. And we have to keep that in mind as we think about what we might do in the future.
Dr. Schmidt, there isn't a person in this room that wouldn't have traded places with you in a heartbeat to be able to stand on the moon and look back at the Earth. But if you could put us in that spot, tell us about the place you visited.
Well, the Valley of Tarsilitro was really a magnificent spot. I know Gene sees it in his mind, I see it in mine. It was indeed a valley deep in the Grand Canyon at the narrowest point to where we landed. It was only 4 miles across. The mountains on either side rose to 6,000 and 7,000 feet above us. They were, in a sense, silhouetted against a blacker-than-black sky being illuminated by a brighter-than-bright sun. And, of course, any time you wanted to look up and see home, all you had to do was look over the South Massif, and there was the Earth, this beautiful blue and white, little specks of red and orange on it from the deserts. It was just a spectacular place to be, and Gene and I were absorbing it continuously. I know Gene thought that I was a little bit flippant when he said, Jack, when you get out here, you have to take a look at the Earth. And I said, Gene, you've seen one Earth, you've seen them all.
That was before he saw this one.
And I said that because I had had a wonderful time on the way to the moon observing the weather patterns on the Earth, practicing my hobby of meteorology and trying to forecast what I would see the next day as the Earth rotated beneath us. And so I probably was a little flippant when I said that, but that's what I was thinking at the time. And indeed, you've got to remember that when you do look at the Earth in space or anywhere else, you've seen one, you've seen them all.
On the Space Show, we're marking the 50th anniversary of the return to Earth of Apollo 17. And now we have Bap Kennedy about the right stuff. And it is not only astronauts who have the right stuff. And this was written by Bap and inspired and dedicated to the Apollo astronauts.
Longing for a mission once again. Gambling everything, boys, we were fearless. So farewell, my friends, till we meet again in some bar where angels fear to tread. Some have already gone, but it won't be long till we're all together again. Time is such a strange arrangement. You think you have too much and then it's gone. But I know this world will keep on turning when you and me have slipped this mortal cord. So farewell, my friends, till we meet again in some power angel. Have already gone, but it won't be long till we're all together again. So farewell, my friends, till we meet again in some power angel. Some have already gone, but it won't be long till we're all together again. And we'll have that right stuff again.
Bep Kennedy with the right stuff, pointing out that it's not only astronauts who have the right stuff. Yes, there are police in Queensland who certainly have the right stuff. Coming up in a few moments is the police. Now we go back to the Adler Planetarium, recorded in 2012, and journalist Phil Rogers is in conversation with astronauts Gene Cernan, Harrison Schmidt, and Jim Lovell.
And Captain Cernan, you put it best when I spoke to you earlier today. I remember, Captain Lovell, you said that you remembered that you could hide the moon behind your thumb. You said to me today it felt like you could just reach out and take it home with you.
Yeah. First of all, the Earth that Jack's talking about, overpowering beauty, was captivating. You know, as busy as we were on the moon, you had to steal an involuntary look over your shoulder at the Earth. And one of the things about the landing, you know, I don't want to go through the whole thing, but it was a pretty busy time. The ground's talking to you, Jack's talking to you, and you're looking at needles, you're looking at where you're going to land. You only get one shot. 14 minutes of probably the most dynamic period of time in a human being's life until you get down there where Jack called it dust. But the whole time, out the window, I see the Earth. And it was hard to take my eyes off it. It's that imposing on you. And I got some different views from other people, maybe. And I've always felt there were two space programs, one in Earth orbit. You fly around the Earth every 90 minutes. You fly over a city, a river, a lake, across the ocean in 15 minutes. You're lucky you might get a glimpse of your own hometown. But you're only 150, 200 miles away from home. When you leave the Earth and you accelerate to some 25,000 miles an hour, and Jim knows exactly what I'm talking about, it's a different space program, not just technologically, but philosophically and I use the word spiritually as well. And we all have our own views as we look back. And not to, you go out there and that Earth grows smaller very, very, very quickly as you head out to the moon, until, as you all saw on Apollo 17, Jim Lovell and Tom Hanks did indeed put his thumb over and he blotted out his identity. I call it your identity with reality. That's everything you know, you understand, your past, your family, your love, your emotions, the future. That's it right there. I sort of look at it, Jack, as we lived in a world of science fiction. It was a temporary environment for us to live and work and enjoy and whatever. But when I say, I don't mean this to be religious by any means, because you can dress your God in whatever way you want him, him or her. You can call him by whatever name you want him. But for me, spiritually, it was like I was sitting on God's front porch for 3 days of my life, looking back at a small part of his creation. And that's just the way I felt. That's a feeling I had then. I went to the moon twice. I had that challenge. I felt that way on my first trip without landing, because you're that far away. And when I really got the ultimate opportunity to be on the moon, just reinforced what my feelings were that I came home with.
Phil, there were two I found very intriguing bookends to the mission. The Earth orbit part that Gene referred to, as we were in our first orbit over the United States before we left for the moon, the whole country was almost entirely covered by clouds, except for Florida, where we had left. And as I was looking down on Miami, a shooting star went across beneath us.
I missed that.
Over Miami.
I miss that.
And 3.5 days later, we were in our first orbit around the moon with the so-called dark part of the moon illuminated by Earthlight. And I was looking near the crater Grimaldi. Some of you will know where Grimaldi is. And just above Grimaldi, I was watching, and there was a flash of light. A meteor had hit the moon. So I not only saw a meteor go underneath us, I saw one hit the moon before we ever landed there. And those are sort of two observational bookends that were really very intriguing to me. It really lets you know that you're someplace different.
You know, again, one of the significant things that we mentioned tonight is that we never went back. And Captain Lovell is your friend of many, many years, but I'm going to ask you to be an impartial observer tonight. Would you let people know just what was the significance of this mission? And since it was the last trip to the moon, what should we take away from it?
Well, I kind of think the significance of Apollo 17 was really the capstone of the Apollo program. It consequently, it involved and encapsulated in one mission, 3 days, just about everything that we had planned to do, we wanted to do, and we accomplished. So in reality, it was sort of closing the door on the Camelot, really, of manned spaceflight as we knew it at that time.
And we never dreamed. We knew it was the last trip to the moon for the time being, but we never dreamed it would be 4 decades till we went back. I wonder if we could start with you and just have you reflect on that and just sort of where do you think we are now? And I'd like to hear from all three.
You really don't want to take me there.
Well, remember these folks do. They are supposed to have dinner tonight. So, although I'm sure you all would gladly give up dinner to hear more of this.
Yeah. So. You know, it's we're all speaking for ourselves, I think, for the most part. But it's extremely disappointing. To refer to what Jim said, we should have been the encapsulation of everything that happened before us. We built on what they did. We built on our mistakes. We built on our successes. So Apollo 17, we didn't have any problems. No. The only problem we had, the only scare I had on Apollo 17, you saw it in this movie, Jack yells out, "Orange soil!" I knew right then and there we'd been on the moon too long. I knew right then and there he'd been sucking up too much oxygen. But, you know, it's disappointing. We knocked, you know, it was a period of time from 13 years of my life, but from Shepard in 61 to Apollo 17 in 72, we busted that door to the future open. We busted it open for those walking in our footsteps to go on through it. And here we are, literally four decades later, and we can't even get an American into space on an American piece of hardware. We've come full circle, taking the leadership away from the old Soviet Union to giving it back to them a half a century later. Now, what's wrong with that headline? You know, we had a headline, American steps foot on the moon. And now the headlines are, golly, we're sending clean laundry to the space station. What's wrong with that? That's what bothers me tremendously. And we haven't been afraid to say it. You know, what we've said publicly has been challenged by a lot of people, but that's just what we believe.
The Space Show, commemorating Apollo 17, 50 years. We'll return to the Adler Planetarium momentarily.
Hi, this is Darlinghurst.
Wishing you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And you're listening to Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
We now return to the Adler Planetarium, recorded in 2012, November the 13th. Astronauts Gene Cernan, Harrison Schmitt and Jim Lovell are in discussion with journalist Phil Rogers.
Dr. Schmitt?
Well, the geopolitical significance of space hasn't changed since the Apollo program was conceived. Eisenhower and Kennedy both recognized that the world was changing very rapidly in the middle of the Cold War. Eisenhower, by beginning the construction of what became the Saturn V and working with McCormick and Johnson, House and Senate leaders, to build NASA, to create NASA, and then setting the stage for really 18 months before Kennedy could make his made his announcement after Al Shepard's successful flight, and his challenge issued his challenge to go to the moon and return safely to Earth, geopolitical environment really hasn't changed. If the United States expects to be the primary protector of freedom on this planet, I don't think we can afford to be looking into the future to headlines that Gene implied that says China has landed on the moon and has established a base. That's not going to work. If one of your primary functions in this world, geopolitical functions, is to protect freedom. So I think we have to very seriously, as a country, whatever the leadership does, we have to very seriously, as a country, consider the fact that space leadership is an absolute necessity for the country. And if we don't decide to lead, then I think we're going to be in pretty serious trouble. Now, can NASA take on a task of deep space exploration today? Probably not.
I think so.
For one thing, as I indicated earlier, it's too old. The average age of NASA is twice what it was during Apollo. People have learned how to fail. They've learned how to just hold a job. All due respect and the great things that NASA has done and some and still does, it probably should disperse those functions that it has today into other agencies, continue to take care of our international obligations relative to the International Space Station, and we do have obligations. But if you're going to have a deep space exploration program, then I think you need a new agency. And that agency has to be configured so it can last indefinitely with young people running it. The inside of it. There'll be older people. We were in our 30s. The senior managers may have been in their 40s. But I'm talking about people in their 20s have to be able to. And if you want an example of where we have done that successfully, it's in the management of the nuclear navy. The nuclear navy that protects the freedom of this country continually is a young navy. The average age on those submarines and carriers is less than 25.
And they understood, Rick Over put into place early on a mechanism by which that Navy stayed young. Extraordinarily important.
And you know, Captain Lovell, you and I have talked about this, where, you know, when I was a young person and watching you all fly in space, there was a tremendous sense of wonder in the United States that you all were carrying that for us, but we got to watch. And you and I have talked about this. Nothing's really replaced that now that that's all gone away for America. They don't have anything else to latch onto that was quite like that.
Well, you're absolutely right. We need a new mission, so to speak, something that we can latch onto. And Jack is right, too. Looking at what we are now with NASA, there needs to be some changes to be evolved here. Because our appropriations is really not appropriate for programs of such magnitude. You have to, if you commit yourself, for instance, to build a new aircraft carrier, and you put the funds in for it, which is going to take 7 or 8 years to complete, you can't pull away the funds when the ship's half built. In the same way with the space program. If you want to go back to the moon, and we have to make those basic decisions, you know, now and keep to them, then you fund them. Because I've learned that in Congress, much to my surprise, there are two different parts. One authorizes, which is very easy to do, and one is funding, which is very difficult, if not impossible, to accomplish. And consequently, some things have to be changed if we're to have a viable position in space and be a leader in that particular discipline.
Phil, one of the things I think that's missing in young people today, and it's probably our fault to some degree, is the passion, the desire, the understanding of what American exceptionalism means to us individually and to a country collectively. Probably the apex, the epitome of American exceptionalism came when Jim flew to the moon on Apollo 8. No human beings had ever been to the moon. The world looked at us like they've never looked at us. So Apollo 11 was important, certainly, but Apollo 8, we sent America sent three human beings to the moon. And what did that lead to? I find young men and young women, we all do, that are in their 40s and 50s today, saying, I saw that. I saw you go to the moon. You're so sure you did. I look at their age, you're dead. You were in your diapers. Your dad put you in front of the television and said, watch it. Someday you're going to say you saw him go to the moon. But the important thing is, they come up to the, you hear it all the time. Thank you. Thank you, Captain Lovell. Thank you, Jack Schmidt. Thank you, Gene Cernan, for what you did for me. I'm a doctor. I'm a teacher. I'm an engineer. I'm a scientist. I'm an astronomer because of what you did. It wasn't what we did. And these are 40 and 50-year-old people. It's what the country did. And yes, we need the funding. Yes, we need stability. Yes, we need leadership. But we need the passion, the desire. We've never been a country, a nation, in my lifetime, that's ever accepted second best. Until now. And that's what's missing. We need to reestablish the passion of what America, of what growing up in America is all about. Now,
the real
space, let me just say, space is the most visible thing we can put our hands on that instills that kind of passion in young people. And there's nothing out there today. There's nothing there. Space station, wonderful scientific laboratory in space. I don't quite frankly really know what it's doing or what it's sending back. Maybe we'll find a cure for cancer. I do know it's a great asset and it's very important. But it didn't turn anybody on. Katie, you want to go to the moon? Sure you do. Sure you do. But there isn't anything that excites Katie because we're not going to the moon. We need to get people excited. We need to give this younger generation that Jack talks about something to hang their hat on, some goal.
I would just add to that, Gene, that in order to accomplish what you have described and would like to accomplish, I really think there has to be a counter-revolution in education. The education system overall, many exceptions, but still overall in this country, is failing to give young people the tools, the intellectual tools they need in order to understand what it means to be exceptional, how to be exceptional, and what it is going to take for the country as a whole to be exceptional. And until we get control of that education system back, and I don't mean we, I mean parents get control of that education system again, I don't see how we're going to establish the exceptionalism, the spirit of exceptionalism that Gene has talked about.
That conversation taking place in the Adler Planetarium in 2012. We have more coming up, but first, let's pick up on that theme of American enterprise. Patterson Hood has this song called Putting People on the Moon. It's about a town just downriver from NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. That's the center that built the Saturn V rockets and the Artemis rocket, the space launch system. This describes the difficulty of workers laid off with the closure of the Ford factory, followed by layoffs at NASA. And this was recorded in 2011.
Goddamn Reagan's in the White House and nobody gives a damn. Got her budget unemployment, DEA shutting soon. No Larry Munsville putting people on the moon. It's really tough to make a living, but a man still gotta try. And if I died in Carver County, would it make the evening news? I'm too busy blowing rockets, putting people on the moon.
Upon us, but it's sucking left on tit, and the preacher on the TV says it ain't too late for me, but I bet he drives a Cadillac.
On the Space Show, that was Patterson Hood.
88.3 Southern FM.
The Space Show now returns to the Adler Planetarium in 2012, where astronauts Gene Cernan, Harrison Schmitt and Jim Lovell are discussing the Apollo 17 mission.
Captain Lovell, you were one of those kids in school that wanted to learn about rockets, I remember. You're right in tune with this same thinking.
Well, yes, and I was turned on when there wasn't a space program, and so,
That was before God created water, right?
Gotcha!
Way back there. But you're right, Phil. You have to have a passion of some sort. Not so much that the space program is the catalyst that gives the people a passion. But young people have to latch on to something that they really like to do. Whether you like, astronomy, or whether you like flowers and you want to be a botanist, or you want to do, but you start following a pattern, and that's, I think, what gets people started. And I think the space program was just a factor for a lot of people who like to have engineering things going on and want to do that type of work, was the incentive to go follow what they have done and then do what they want to do and keep on going. The people I meet, every day who are over 50 say, I got started because I watched you on the landing or going around the moon, as far as I was concerned. That makes me kind of old, come to think of it. But
you are.
Let me tell you a little anecdote here. I was in in mission control, and when Jim was in orbit around the moon, and they did 10 orbits, as I recall. I should remember since I helped you plan them.
But 10 orbits.
And on the last orbit, the key thing that everybody was waiting for was the timing of AOS, acquisition of signal, when they would come around the moon. And of course, that was, did the engine fire, and were they going to make exactly the right time when we got their signal? If it was off, then we knew they had a problem with that engine. The place was packed. The viewing room, you couldn't have levered another person into that viewing room. It's the same with Michigan. And sure enough, right on time, here they come, everybody cheered. Two missions later, this young man, then young man, was in orbit around the moon. Same situation, had to fire that engine to come around. I looked around, I was in mission control again at the Capcom console. I looked around, nobody in the viewing room. We've done that. And that's, I think, illustrates what we're talking about, is that the excitement that comes with knowledge and understanding that generations of young people overall are not getting today is extraordinarily important for this country or any other country to do great things.
You got us on a roll. Let me add one more thing. The problem today, and it's our fault perhaps, mom and dad, our school system, whatever it is, we have become risk averse. What's in it for me? If I take a job when I got out of college, how many vacation days do I get? What's my bonus going to be? Do you think today we would be bold enough to put three of our colleagues on the top of a Saturn V, the largest rocket in the world, for the first time, and on top of that, not just launch them, send them to the moon? That was bold. We were bold during those days. We need to be once again bold today. Someone asked me a question earlier in the day, how long would it take us to go to the moon if we said started tomorrow? Twice? Three times? As long as it took us back in the 60s, 70s? But a heck of a lot longer, I'm positive of that.
You know, Phil,
that's sad commentary.
When we, in between November of 1968, with the launch of Apollo 7, which was almost on a Saturn V, in November of 1969, we launched a Saturn V, or its equivalent, once every 2 months. Think about that. Once every 2 months, one of those rockets left the Earth.
Headed to the moon.
Headed to the moon. And it was a bunch of 25-year-olds that were doing it.
And they were 25-year-olds with slide rules who told you, if you fire the engine just long enough, we are just certain it's going to put you into lunar orbit.
You know, when,
and you trusted them.
When we launched, when we launched on 17, the ground said, you guys are right on trajectory. It was perfect. You're going to miss the moon by 50 miles. You don't remember this, but I mumbled back to him. I said, I sure hope so. Slide rules. We flew with slide rules in those early days. Took a slide rule on Gemini. Figure out how you're going to rendezvous. People, no, it, well, looking at the age, half of the people don't know what a slide rule is.
You flew with Omega watches to keep time, and my friend Paul Knappenberger
is keeping time on
is
us.
Keeping time on us, and I believe you've told me that I can't go
We're
any longer.
Fun, Paul.
I think if we took a vote, people would just,
sure
you know.
Please join me in thanking our wonderful guests.
Recorded on November the 13th of 2012 in Chicago at the Adler Planetarium, they were astronauts Gene Cernan, who went to the moon twice, once orbited and once to land, Harrison Smith, who went to the moon once and a geologist, and Jim Lovell, who went to the moon twice. The second mission he was supposed to land, but the spacecraft exploded on the way there, so he had to loop around the moon and come back. And he has set the human record for the most distant spaceflight done by a human. So that's that. Now, all three of the astronauts that were on that mission have been to Melbourne. The space show has met two of them. And here is what Harrison Smith, the geologist, had to say when he was speaking in Frankston about what it's like to see a sunrise.
We could watch sunrises, and they are spectacular from behind the mountain, believe me. The sun has all sorts of activity coming streaming out away from it. There's a zodiacal light. These streamers that come from various eruptions on the solar surface. And then just before sunrise, each of those streamers has this brilliant jagged blade of light right in the middle of it. And then, of course, you need to look away. You don't want to be staring at the sun too long, watching it rise in space.
And Harrison Smith, while he was on the moon, recited a poem. This was recited at 183 hours and 30 minutes ground elapsed time, which was at 5:23 Australian Eastern Daylight Time, December 15. And in it, he refers to Gordon Fullerton, an astronaut who, at the time, had not flown in space. He later flew three of the five space shuttle approach and landing tests. They were in the atmosphere, not in space. And the third orbital space mission that orbited the Earth. So here's Jack Smith with It's the Week Before Christmas.
Hey, Hey, Gordy, in honor of one of your comm handovers last night, and in the tradition of Apollo 8, I've got a paraphrase of a familiar poem for you.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, it's a week before Christmas and all through the limp. Not a commander was stirring, not even stirring. The samples were stowed in their places with care, in hopes that with you they soon will be there. And Cernan, Dean in his hammock, and I in my cap, had just settled our brains for a long, short lunar nap. And up on the Kamloops, there rose such a scatter, I sprang from my hammock to see what was the matter. Sun on the breast of the surface below gave the luster of objects as if in snow. And what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature rover and 8 tiny reindeer and a little old driver so lively and quick I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. I heard him explain as he over the hills heated speed, Merry Christmas to all and to you all Godspeed.
Very good.
Gordo, that's the first time I heard that, and I gotta say that was beautiful.
I agree. Did the elephant get any sleep, or did he spend all night composing that?
People always said we ought to have a poet in space. I don't think we've made it yet. No, for some reason, I really woke up with one of your handovers last night, and that was how I went back to sleep.
Reading From the Moon. That was Jack Smith, the geologist who walked on the moon. And I must say he's a better reader of poetry than I am, but hey, I'm going to give it a go. Now, Tegan Blackwood is a poet who lives in Columbia, a town in the United States state of Missouri. She has had a lifelong enthusiasm for astronomy and space exploration, and she has written this poem about Apollo 17. It's simply called Apollo 17. On a distant corner drawn on a rime dark sea, there is forever Earth. We came in peace from our own cold wastes of terror, lit a fire hungered for in the nights of forgotten mothers when the sky was a belly full of stories, made a new unbrutal mist for subtle, lolling, heavy-headed necks to crane against and settle. And then we were gone, dots bursting and fading in a pale, and the miles became as long as they used to be, in the same way that a track trudged too often feels slower by the day. How, in a boxed inset on the page of a single file, does impossibility become unremarkable and vanish back to paper on a drywall nursery? As removed from sinuous cave wall lines as I am from blooming hips in the unkindled lap of long ago, as forlorn as a glimpsed beacon of escape in a rush of wind in the hush of night, from a prison never before perceived to be that turns to the reassuring crimson blip of the hallway smoke alarm, while the twilight deepens on the popcorn ceilings and the shades are drawn. Was the man caught between in free fall, footprintless, the loneliest who ever was? Does the fading recall of the touched beyond haunt less than suppressing fire in the eyes of a man returned to sender, not unmarked? How lonely we must all be, we all together twisting on the spit of a reach whose grip exceeded it, and on the desert island of our bearers' bones, merciless, without a hand to grasp in the gathering shadows or any road to ever take us home. Helene Knox has written this poem called NASA. Parapets within a spoon, streaked of truth within a lie, astronauts collect the moon, then splash home to die. And speaking of dying, Ronald Evans died in 1990, April, of a heart attack. In his sleep, he was aged 56. Gene Cernan died in 2017, January, of failing health. He was aged 82, and that was not long after he had visited us here in Melbourne. Now, Harrison Schmidt is now aged 87, and he is still an active geologist. Another poem, this time by Lillian Fisher. The moon has no light of its own. It is cold and dark and dead as stone, but it catches light from the burning sun and shows itself when each day is done. Jane Lowen has written a letter to the moon. Dear old moon, your new face has human footprints every place. The astronauts did not take care and walked upon you everywhere. But worse, they left behind a mess that surely causes you distress. Forgive us, moon. Please keep your glow with love from all of us below. I think we'll leave our poetry there and just hear a little bit of Billy Bragg, The Space Race Is Over. This is a reflection by Billy of his childhood memories of watching the Apollo space missions. He bitterly concludes that, and I quote, "Now that the space race is over, it's been and it's gone, and I'll never get to the moon."
When I was young, I told my mom to walk on the moon someday. Armstrong and Aldrin spoke to me, Houston and Cape Kennedy, and to watch the eagle land in on a night when the moon was full. And as it tugged I knew that deep inside I too could feel it. Ooh. Lie in my bed and dreamed I walked a sea of tranquility. I knew that someday soon we'd all sail to the moon, from the high tide of technology, the dreams had all been taken, and the window seats taken too, and 2001 is almost come and gone. What am I supposed to do now that the space race is over?
And that's Billy Bragg, The Space Race Is Over, and we'll try to play the full song all 4 minutes, 27 seconds of it, in next week's The Space Show, which is going to be mostly music, but we'll also have something about Apollo